Malachi chapter 2 verse 16 to chapter 4 verse 6, the second and final talk in a series on Malachi, was presented by Gil Greco on September 27, 2020 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Malachi handout number 1 accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Online Reformation Fellowship. My name is Gil Greco. We have just started a series on Malachi last week that we're going to finish today. Last week, we looked at essentially the first two chapters of Malachi. We have another verse or so to go. The first two chapters opened with Yahweh reminding Israel that he loved them. Now, the Israelites might have found this dubious because just over the pond, as it were, Edom, who are the descendants of Esau, have just been taken over by, scholars believe, by the Nabataeans. And Israel could be looking, it seems that Israel is looking over at them and thinking, well, they're probably just going to rebuild. They're probably just going to rebuild their walls and their temples like we just did. And that means that a nation falling and rebuilding itself is just part of the cycle of history. What's special about us? And God has reassured them that because they are the children of Jacob instead of the children of Esau, that he is going to demonstrate at the end of history that it is Jacob that he has loved and Esau that he has hated, that he has chosen the children of Israel and not the children of Edom. As such, even if Edom right now begins to rebuild and reconstruct itself, God will tear them down. And Israel will see that God has purposed for Israel to be his nation and that God has power outside of his own nation. Last week, I talked about how it is very important to remember that Malachi seems to be set up very similarly to a Greek drama. The way that the discussion goes, it's almost as if you have a chorus of Israelites on the one side and God, or possibly the prophet speaking for God, on the other side. And they go back and forth. And the whole book is broken up into these units of God making some kind of accusation, the people responding with confusion because they don't really understand what God is talking about, and then God sort of showing how it is that they are doing what he is accusing them of. Now, as I talked about last week, the way that this manifests itself is he keeps referring to them saying things. Again, the imagery of theater is very helpful here. If any of you are familiar with Shakespeare, it is very common for characters to have soliloquies where they get up in front of the entire audience and basically explain everything about their inner motivations. Usually the conceit of the theater is, even if there are other characters on stage somewhere, if a character is delivering a soliloquy, it's as if the character is pondering this in their own mind and the other characters aren't aware of it or don't hear it. So at various times, God will say that the people of Israel are saying something. And he doesn't mean that they are sort of walking around in the marketplace shouting out loud these sorts of things. What he is doing is he is saying that if they were to give a soliloquy, if they were to state their real motives, if it were possible to lay bare what their real motivations are, then those motivations would be the things that he says. So I think keeping in mind that we are in this sort of Greek drama as we're going through Malachi, I think is important. We're going to see several more instances of that kind of interaction between God and the children of Israel. After he reminded the people of his love, he started addressing this chorus of different people. And he started addressing different sort of subgroups within that chorus. The first group he starts with are the priests who have been offering unacceptable offerings, animals that are blind or lame. God tells them that this is unacceptable because at the end of time, every nation on the face of the planet will offer themselves as an offering to God. While he is on the topic of inappropriate offerings, he turns to regular Israelites who are not priests, but who are making vows to God and swearing that they will offer some kind of sacrifice. But when they actually come to offer the sacrifices, they are offering blind animals, lame animals, and he adds animals who are taken by violence. In other words, the taken by violence phrase I was arguing are animals that have been sort of stolen by wolves or something. So essentially, these people are offering roadkill as the offerings that they have sworn to Yahweh, and that is not acceptable. Then he turns back to the priests and tells them that they have failed to pass on the commandments that were handed to them. And he talks a lot about the covenant of Levi. And I think the covenant of Levi is standing for the Mosaic covenant. Moses is a son of Levi, and he is the most significant son of Levi in a lot of ways. And the way that God talks about Levi, all of the things that he says fit very well with what Moses was doing. So the priests who are failing in passing on these commandments, they don't value the covenant of Levi. They don't value the Mosaic covenant. So what God tells them is that at the end of time, and in fact, even at this time, it is becoming clear that they are cursed following what God told them would happen in Deuteronomy if they did not follow the commandments, because they are not keeping the commandments wholeheartedly. He says they are showing partiality in the Torah. What he hopes will happen as a result of the priests encountering this curse and in some sense dying because of, not in some sense, some of them are going to die as part of the judgment of not passing on the commandments. And what he hopes this will accomplish is that it will be clear that Moses and the Mosaic covenant, or Levi and the covenant of Levi, are vindicated by God. So even though that's not happening at the moment, he's hoping that before he gets to the spot where all of them have to be wiped out, the curse that he is unleashing on the Levites, and he specifically talks about how they are barren. He makes reference to the offspring, and it seems like that could include their livestock and their crops. All of those things are cursed, and he's hoping that that curse will be sufficient to make them realize that they need to take the covenant of Levi seriously, because that's the covenant that God has given them. Then he turns back to the Israelites. Apparently the Israelites have married foreign women, and Yahweh tells them that they have profaned the holiness of Yahweh by marrying foreign women. Last week when I was talking about it, I went with the NASB, the New American Standards translation of sanctuary, and I was saying that sanctuary is standing in for everything having to do with the worship of Yahweh. But as I was looking at the passage this week, because it's some of the things in this section are going to get referenced later, I found out that the word that is translated sanctuary by the NASB is just the Hebrew word for holiness. And I think that says more directly what I was trying to get across last week with my argument about sanctuary. They are pretending like there are other gods of significance, and they are trying to avail themselves of the assistance of those other gods by marrying the daughters of the nations who worship those other gods. So by marrying these foreign women, they are denigrating the holiness of God. They are essentially saying that God is not holy, he is not other, he's not the one God. There are other gods that are as important as he is. Furthermore, this same group of Israelites who has married foreign wives has apparently acted treacherously to their Jewish wives, either by divorcing their wives, or they have been practicing polygamy and just marrying these foreign wives so that they can have both sort of the insurance of both Yahweh and these foreign wives. It is not clear from the text that actual divorces are going on. Malachi uses this phrase, the wife of your youth, which I argued last week. The reference we have for that in the Old Testament is Solomon and David, who married a lot of women in order to make political alliances. The wife of their youth referred to sort of their first Jewish wife. And I think that that language is indicating that even though perhaps they have not divorced their Jewish wives, they haven't left them sort of to their own devices, thrown them out in the cold, they are essentially divorcing them, and God hates that they have treated their wives in this way. I also argued last week that what God wants from Israelite marriages are godly offspring. I think that that is an idea that is important to realize. We talked about that when we were looking at Ezra and Nehemiah. In Ezra, when the Jewish men decide that they need to confess that they have married foreign wives, it makes a special note that some of the foreign women had even had children. And I talked about how part of why it is important not to allow foreigners to marry into Israel is not because there's some kind of idea of ethnic purity, but because if you have differences of religion, that's going to change the worship of Yahweh, and we're looking for a pure worship of Yahweh. So I do think that that is a true idea that is sort of behind some of the things that are said in the Bible. However, this week I was talking to Noah Crabtree, who was kind enough to walk me through the Hebrew of those last couple of verses that we looked at last week. I did not feel like I had done a good job of explaining exactly what was happening, but it turns out that the Hebrew is extremely complicated and possibly broken, that just because of the time between us and the original documents, we may not have a clear idea of exactly what's going on. It's also possible that it's just extremely difficult. Given the discussion I had with Noah, there were two or three other possibilities that came up for what that could be talking about, which I won't go into here, but I am not necessarily convinced anymore that the passage I was talking about was solely focused on having children who are godly being the main focus of what Malachi is saying there. But in any case, in that section, it is clear that Yahweh stands against those who have acted treacherously against their wives. So now that we've gone through these first two chapters, I think we can start to get a picture of the situation that Malachi is prophesying into. I am cheating because I know what happens in the rest of the book, and I will draw particular attention to further things as they come up that consolidate or that reinforce the idea that I'm going to that I'm going to mention here, but I'm essentially now going to construct the picture as I see it of what Malachi is prophesying into based on what we have seen and what we will see. I will try to speak only to what we have seen so far, and then as we go farther, I will point out, see, this is another factor sort of contributing to this picture that I've made. So Malachi told the priests in the section we looked at last week that he was cursing their offering already, which reminded us of the promises in Deuteronomy that if the people did not keep the commandment, that they would be cursed in a bunch of visible ways. There were signs to be rendered from the curses. People would not have good crops. They would not have good animals. They themselves would not have children. And there were all sorts of other consequences that would be, you could easily see if the people were not following the law within Israel. We saw that there were two instances of people offering animals, but those animals were not good animals, which seems to indicate that the people are keeping back the good animals because of the sort of desperation that they're in. They're keeping the good animals because they want to have those animals available should they need them for food. Also, one of the groups who is dealing with animals are people who swear falsely. It's not common at all in my life anymore, but I'm sure we're all familiar with the idea, praying to God, God, I swear that if you help me pass this test that I didn't study for, I will, you know, it's usually nowadays, I will never do something. But in their day, it was, God, if you will help me pass this test, I will offer you a lamb or a goat. So these people are clearly feeling desperate because they're interested in that sort of bargaining with God. And yet when they actually get to the place where they are offering those animals, they are offering lame or blind or roadkill animals instead of offering the best animals that they have available. Also, the mixed marriages seem to imply that people are looking for help from outside of Israel. Maybe Baal or Marduk has some help that they can offer me, and what I need to do is I need to form alliances with people who have some tie to those gods, so that those gods favor me, or at least are not actively trying to hurt me. So all of these things point to a kind of desperation, a kind of need that the people of Israel have to preserve their resources. And so I think what is happening, and I have not attempted to tie this in exactly to what's happening in Ezra Nehemiah, to tie it into the situation I was talking about when we were looking at what exactly happens with Israel's neighbors tearing down their walls and burning it and et cetera, that I went into at some length. But it seems that what's happening is there's some kind of famine in the land, that there are scarce resources, and that rather than focusing on worshiping Yahweh, the people are using any tactic that they can think of to keep themselves safe. They are skimping on good animals. They are doing religious, they are practicing religions which are different from Yahweh's in the hopes that those will bring sort of new blessings to them, that the current situation with the famine and the fact that they are, you know, they have ostensibly rebuilt the temple and they have returned from the Babylonian captivity. But this is just sort of par for the course in their thinking, that we are following Yahweh, but Yahweh is not really all that different from these other gods. And we've restored all of this stuff, but nothing exceptional seems to be happening here. We seem to be just as susceptible to famine as anywhere else. And, you know, we just need to take the practical steps to take care of ourselves, despite this fact that we're supposed to follow Yahweh in this particular way. We're just being very pragmatic in how we go about things. Okay, so let's get into our text today. We will continue to see this sort of attitude developed, and we will see a couple more things that speak to the situation. I am in paragraph 9 of my handout. That is 217 and following. You have wearied Yahweh with your words. Yet you say, how have we wearied him? In that you say, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of Yahweh, and he delights in them. Or, where is the God of justice? So if we have, so as I said earlier, right, we have this play, we have Yahweh saying, you have wearied Yahweh with your words, or you have Malachi saying, you have wearied Yahweh with your words. The people respond, how have we wearied him? We don't really know what you're talking about. And then Malachi responds, what you guys really think, what you guys are really saying is, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of Yahweh. The way things appear in the world right now, if God is an all-powerful God, he must be into evil things. The stuff that he considers good must be evil because that's what's going on right now. He delights in evil. And they also are saying, where is the God of justice? If God is so good, if he's interested in goodness, if he's interested in upholding, you know, the downtrodden and the orphan and the widow, where is he? There doesn't seem to be a lot of justice going on. The people who are doing bad things seem to run around with impunity and nobody is stopping them. Where is God? This is the response. I believe this is 3:1. Behold, I am going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me. And the Adonai, whom you seek, will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says Yahweh of hosts. So what is Yahweh's response to the question, where is the God of justice? He says that first he will send his messenger to clear the way. This is one of those spots where it would be helpful to know Hebrew, because as far as I can tell, there isn't a direct object. So he says, I'm going to send my messenger and he will clear the way. And then the me before me is apparently supplied by the translators. So they are taking Yahweh to be speaking and he's saying, the messenger will come and clear the way before me. But as far as I could tell from what the translators was saying and from my very rudimentary perusal of the Hebrew of this section, apparently the me is added. It's just this messenger is going to come and he's going to clear the way. This language is very similar to Isaiah 40. There's a voice crying out in the wilderness, make straight the way of our God. And this verse in Malachi is found, there are variations of this verse found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It is interesting that in those gospels, the verse is slightly altered so that it sounds like God is speaking to the Messiah, because in every instance, well, not in every instance, what it said, what it, the way that it is changed, it says, he will prepare the way before you. And in Luke and Matthew, Jesus is the one who quotes the verse that way. It's interesting that he quotes it that way because that might be reflecting his understanding that the verse is being directed to him as the Messiah. And as such, he feels free to alter the pronouns to sort of clarify what the verse is saying. And this might have interesting implications for, you know, Matthew and Luke and Mark. As Ryan's been going through Mark, he's talked a little bit about the synoptic problem, which is how do Matthew, Luke, and Mark relate to each other? And if Luke and Matthew are quoting Jesus and his understanding, that might mean that Mark is later than they are, and that he is reflecting what Jesus said about this prophecy, this idea of this prophecy. And in Mark, he says that Isaiah said this, and so it could be the case that Mark understands that Isaiah and Malachi and Jesus are all talking about the same thing, and thus he feels free to say, you know, like Isaiah said, and then he actually quotes Jesus, who is riffing on Malachi. That is a very complicated sort of issue, and hopefully that is helpful to Ryan as he's moving forward in his Mark studies, and hopefully that's interesting to you as you move forward and look at how the Old Testament quotes, or excuse me, how the New Testament quotes the Old Testament. But I thought that was interesting. Anyway, I digress. The messenger is going to clear the way, and then the Lord will suddenly come to his temple. So if you're looking at a real New American Standard Bible, actually most standard English Bibles, they will have Lord there, but it will not be in all caps. It will be capital L and then lowercase ORD. When English Bibles have Lord written that way, the underlying Hebrew is Adonai, which I have supplied in my handout. Adonai is a messianic title, most famously from Psalm 110, which starts with the Lord, that is Yahweh, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, said to my Lord, only capital L. So Yahweh said to my Adonai, and then the thing goes on, and that is the psalm which the author of Hebrews spends a lot of time working through as he's trying to express what it is that Jesus did when he offered himself as a sacrifice. So I think this section of Malachi is prophesying that in the end, the Messiah is going to come to his temple. So it says, the Adonai whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming. I take this second phrase, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, to be parallel to the first, to that first phrase, or the first clause, about the Adonai will suddenly come to his temple. Which means that we are still talking about the Messiah as the messenger of the covenant. Now, we have antecedents for the Messiah being talked in this way. We were just talking about the author of Hebrews, and the author of Hebrews opens up Hebrews by talking about how in these last days, Yahweh, God, has spoken to us through his Son. So when Jesus arrives on the scene, he is the final word. He is the final prophet of what it is that Yahweh is doing in the world. And so to call him the messenger of the covenant would be appropriate if that's the sort of role that we have in mind. We also remember that in Deuteronomy, Moses said that he would bring forth a prophet like Moses who would speak to the people. And it is very interesting that when Moses says that in Deuteronomy, the thing he is immediately talking about before that is how all of the other nations will consult sorcerers and diviners. And in a couple of verses, we're going to get to Yahweh condemning sorcerers and diviners. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get there. And many have taken Moses' discussion of prophets, of the prophet coming after him, to be talking about the Messiah. Finally, back when he was talking to the priests about being responsible for delivering the commandments, he noted that they were supposed to be messengers of Yahweh and that they were failing in this endeavor. And it is interesting to remember further about Deuteronomy that the role that the Davidic king was supposed to have was for the Davidic king to be the leading expert on the law. He was supposed to copy out the law by hand so that he knew what the commandment was, and so that he would be a king who gave his people the Torah and not a king who waged war and gathered horses and did all of the sorts of things that all of the other kings in the region did. As such, it seems very appropriate that the Messiah is called the Messenger of the Covenant because in Deuteronomy, even, it seems that they are envisioning this king as being the person who is delivering the commandment that the priests that Malachi has talked about earlier in Malachi have failed. They have failed to hand on the commandment in the way that the Messenger of the Covenant, the Messiah, will hand on the covenant. It's very striking that he says, the Messenger of the Covenant in whom you delight. Now, there is some question here. It could be that it is not referring to the messenger, but rather to the covenant in which you delight. Either way, this is an extremely sarcastic comment on the part of Yahweh, because, if you recall, he has just been accused of not being a just God or of delighting in men doing evil. Now, he is responding to them by telling them that the Messiah is going to come and set things to right, and presumably they are cynical that this is ever going to happen. And so when he says, the messenger in whom you delight or the covenant in which you delight, he does not. These are not people who have shown themselves to be people who delight in the covenant or who have this expectation that the covenant or the Messiah will resolve any of these difficulties. They are more inclined to apostasy than they are to hoping that Yahweh will fulfill everything that he has said. So this is an extremely biting sort of sarcasm from Yahweh. And he says, behold, he is coming. And notice that in this section, he says, behold, I'm going to do this, and behold, he is coming. It's very emphatic. How are we going to solve the problem of injustice? What is the answer to the problem of evil, as it's been stated? The Messiah is going to come. All right, let's look at the next section. But who can endure the day of his coming? And who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a smelter and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver, so that they may present to Yahweh offerings in righteousness. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Yahweh as in the days of old and as in former years. Notice that he says, who can endure the day of his coming? The day, the great and terrible day of the Lord, is an idea that is present throughout Old Testament prophecy. And Jack has argued is sort of the main focus of the book of Revelation, that what Revelation is doing is it is continually sort of getting to the great and terrible day of the Lord and then backing up to a different vantage point and then working its way to the great and terrible day of the Lord. I believe Ron has said that we need to think of the idea of this day as we do the phrase in English, every dog has his day. That is, this is the day in which Yahweh is going to be vindicated, that he is going to be shown to be faithful, and that the things that he values and loves and has said that we should value and love will ultimately be saved out from all of the destruction that is going to come upon all of the other things. So, when Messiah comes, the day that he comes will be a day that many people will not endure. Malachi gives us two metaphors for what Messiah is going to be like, what this Adonai is going to be like. He's going to be like refiner's fire and fuller's soap. Refiner's fire, both of these images are metaphors that involve separation. Refiner's fire melts away all of the slag that makes silver alloyed, so that you're left with just pure. It doesn't necessarily have to be silver. That's usually the image, but you're left with just the pure metal and none of the other impurities that would make the metal not quite silver or gold. And fuller's soap, a fuller is somebody who works with wool. So fuller's soap, that's soap that separates the wool, the thing of value, from the dirt and grime that muddy it up and make it less desirable. So the Adonai coming is the one who is going to separate those two things. And this is very reminiscent of Jesus's image of separating the sheep and the goats. It's tempting, and I think there is a good inclination that comes from the idea when he talks about purifying the sons of Levi, that the sons of Levi are going to go through sort of this extreme trial, and some of them will come out better, and that through the process of that trial, they will come out better. But this story that God is telling right now, that the thing that he is talking about right now, is the day when it's over. This is the judgment. This is when the Adonai comes and he separates the sheep from the goats, when he separates the silver from the slag, when he separates the wool from the grime. And that means that there are going to be casualties, that in the day when this happens, you are going to have certain priests who have kept with the covenant of Levi being preserved to vindicate the covenant of Levi, and you're going to have the priests who have not done that passing away. And as we had already seen earlier, that he said, I am cursing you, there will be refuse on your faces, which I argued last week is a reference to the quail that the children of Israel complained they complained of not having meat until they could eat the quail. And while they were still eating it, they vomited it out of their noses, right? A plague came upon them and they died. So there will be Levites who have not held faith with the covenant of Levi, who will be done away with. So Adonai will be like a refiner's fire and like fuller soap. He will sit as a smelter and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver, so that they may present to Yahweh offerings in righteousness. So once the Levites, the sons of Levi, because we're talking about priests, so Levites is a technical term throughout the scripture, but the priests who are the sons of Levi, who have not kept to the Mosaic covenant, who have not kept to the covenant of Levi, they will be done away with, and the only Levites left, the only sons of Levi left, are those who have kept faith and who are able to offer righteous offerings to Yahweh. It says, then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Yahweh and the day, as in the days of old and as in former years. It's very interesting how this passage and other passages throughout the Bible will think about the events of previous eras. Presumably, this is referring to the time of Moses, possibly the time of David, sort of the best days when offerings were being offered. But if we go back and we actually look at the history of Moses and David, we find that there was a lot of stuff that was going on that, you know, in a lot of ways is very similar to the problems that Malachi is encountering. But it seems that part of the thing that is of value is the commitment, the intention, the turning of the heart towards what God wants. And that if you have a people who has the heart to worship God, even if they can't, as a populace, maintain that heart for very long, we should not consider that a false way to think about that moment in history. Cynicism, in a lot of ways, is the death of good things. If you are cynical, then the Israelites offering offerings in the wilderness when God comes down and is in the tabernacle among them, that's not really worth anything, because what good was it, because they just turned around 2 minutes later and were evil again. But the scripture is very challenging, because it believes that, and it talks as if that moment in time when the people gave their offerings freely and then God came down into the tabernacle and they were celebrating the Feast of Booths, that was real. That was the real thing. And I think the thing that we are tempted to do when we encounter those sorts of things is we are tempted to believe that we are a different sort of people because we are smart enough to see that those people were flawed, even though that they were pretending to be such great worshipers of God. But I think the ultimate conclusion that we have to come to when the Bible talks about this is we have to realize everyone is just as alloyed as the people of Israel were. We can have moments when we are truly devoted to God and we are actually doing things that are pleasing to Him. But that does not mean that we are different sorts of people than the people throughout all of history. I have been talking about in Ezra Nehemiah and in various questions throughout my talk that there is this idea that we want to sort of either wallow in our sinfulness, or we want to sort of get past that and be forgiven and move on, and that there's this middle place where we need to remember how patient God is being. But I think there's also another idea that we need to be more careful about, which is that we can be pleasing to God even as it's clear that we are sinners, because our commitments are in the right sort of place. So it is very interesting that Malachi views the offerings of Judah and Jerusalem as pleasing to Yahweh in the days of old, because we know those days of old were very similar to the day that Malachi is in and our day now. And so I think that we need to think about the days of old, not in idealistic terms and not pretend that they were different than they were, but realize that we're not special. We're not more better than them. But that because we are sinners, that does not mean that we cannot do things that please God. Now, obviously, there's a discussion to be had about God giving us the grace to be pleasing to Him and all of that sort of thing. And I'm not going to spend time sort of going into that here. And I think we need to not forget the process of sanctification in this whole discussion. But the Bible talks about people being pleasing, even in the days when we know they were pretty bad. So we need to have that perspective to recognize that sinful people can please God. And we have come from the way that Christianity tends to talk about this. We have come out of a place probably having a lot to do with Luther and the way that he was thinking about things. We have come from a place that says nothing we do is pleasing at all. And we need to gain some perspective that this verse and verses like it point to a sort of different way of conceiving of how sinful human beings can relate to God, even if they are sinful, because their commitments can be in the right place. Okay, this is paragraph 10 in my handout, or 3:5 in a real Bible. Then I will draw near to you for judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against those who swear falsely and against those who press the wage earner in his wages, the widow and the orphan, and those who turn aside the alien and do not fear me, says Yahweh of hosts. For I, Yahweh, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed. So, when Adonai comes, when he acts as the separator, when he casts his judgment on the whole world, as Paul talks about in his sermon on Mars Hill, right? He has appointed a man to judge the living and the dead. That is when you will see Yahweh come in judgment. And at that time, you will see Yahweh be a swift. And this word swift, it does mean fast. But it has this connotation of swift and sure because it's expert witness, right? It's the speed that comes from doing something over and over again. So he will be an expert witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against those who swear falsely, and the rest of the list goes on. I think that we have only a single or a couple new... I think we have a large group that we have not seen before in Malachi. And that is the wage earner, the widow, the orphan, and the alien. Because all of those people are at the mercy of those who have power, are at the mercy of those who are giving out the wages or are giving out the offerings and such to those people. And I think that is the only group that we have not heard about earlier in Malachi. We saw earlier the children of Israel who were marrying foreign women, and that would be the adulterers. We also saw the people who were offering offerings after they were swearing, God, if you let me survive the day, then I will offer you a lamb. And those people were swearing falsely. And then we have this group that is called the sorcerers. But I think we have already seen this group. Let me talk a little bit about the concept of sorcery in the Old Testament. In the Hebrew, the word for sorcerer is literally spell whisperer. Why are you whispering spell? What are you hoping to accomplish when you whisper spells? My assertion is that a spell whisperer hopes that by uttering the correct syllables, he can pull on the invisible levers of the universe, right? If magic is real, if there are syllables that have different power than others, then there should be a spell that I could whisper that would make something happen, right? There we have, fantastical stories about people. They say a spell and, they create light. They say a spell and they levitate things. So a spell whisperer is hoping that he can access powers and, as I said, the invisible levers of the world by just finding the right combination of syllables. The fundamental assumption of a spell whisperer is that the world is basically physics. It may be a kind of magical physics. It may be a physics that doesn't operate on a physical cause and effect sort of way. But if I say the right syllable, then I can make something over there happen that would not have happened if I had not found the right spell. That there is something that I can be the cause of something, that I can cause something with my words, with my spells, that have an effect that are different from me going over there and sort of manually sort of messing with things. But it's a fundamentally sort of materialistic view of how the universe operates. Now, if we think about the priests who are doing their daily offerings by offering blind and lame animals, how are they thinking about how God relates to his people? They are thinking that God has said, do the offerings, and they believe that if they do the offering, it doesn't matter the quality of the offering that they offer, that if they flip the switch of doing an offering, that God will then affect the kinds of blessings that apparently are lacking in Israel in their current situation. That it doesn't need to be of a certain quality, because what matters is the flip switching, not the soul of the person doing the offering, not the intention of the one doing the offering. And this is a theme we see in Jesus and the Psalms, right? That God doesn't want offerings. He wants whole people. But the priests who are offering the offerings, when they offer lame and blind animals, what they assume is any offering is as good as any other. And because it is a switch that causes God to, you know, or, you know, like a gumball machine, you turn the knob and a gumball comes out. You put in the 25 cents, you turn the knob and the gumball comes out. Well, offering an offering is just the same sort of thing. I am offering this offering, so God should bless me. And they don't realize that the dynamic between God and them is much more about their relationship than it is about this action that they're doing. So I think when Malachi says that Yahweh will be a witness against the sorcerers, he is saying Yahweh is going to be a witness against these priests. And that makes it all the more significant that we have sort of in our, we sort of have echoing in our ears this idea that Moses said about the prophet who will come after me, right? This messenger of the covenant, because in that section he had talked about sorcerers and diviners. And the sorcerers and diviners are doing the very same thing the priests of Israel are doing right now. They are acting as if they can manipulate God by pressing the correct invisible switch in the world. And God is not going to be manipulated like that. God wants the people to be to worship him and to be fully devoted to him. And so you will see at the end of time, when Adonai comes and is the judge, that Yahweh is against those who think they can manipulate them, those who think that all that Yahweh requires is just the flip switch of an offering. This is very troubling, because in our current environment, there are a lot of things that we tend to think of as, if you just have the right switch to flip, then you can make lots of different things happen. And I think that in general, the folks around here, we tend to sort of push away the sort of prosperity gospel, that it's easy to think like, oh, well, I get that thinking that I can become very, very wealthy is a trap. I get that, you know, health and wealth, those things are, while they're desirable things, it's like, that's not ultimately what's important, and I can sort of recognize that people are trying to get me by appealing to those desires. But there are much subtler things that, if we're not careful, we can end up thinking that if we flip the right switch, that that's going to be what's going on. Because we need to remember that God is interested in giving us the curriculum that we need in our life. That God is interested in us fulfilling his commandment. God is interested in us loving the things that he loves and loving our enemies. So we need to realize that even if we did all of the right stuff, whatever that was, in order to be successful, even have less ambitious goals, to take care of our families, that sometimes the curriculum that God demands of us is a different one, where we are not as successful as we would like to be. That doesn't give us license to not be wise. It doesn't give us license to try to make good decisions. But we need to realize that God is not a magical, invisible switch that we can flip to make things happen. And we need to be wary of having that attitude, because that is one of the people that God is against. Finally, we have this group who are opposed, or who God is for, because he's against those who oppress the wage earner, the widow, the orphan, and the alien. And it's interesting that as David was going through Exodus, that a lot of the law that is given in Exodus is specifically about those four groups. Unfortunately, at this time, I don't know that I have a lot to say about these that David didn't say better when he was going through Exodus. But I do think that this is a continual cry of the Old Testament that we need to keep in mind, and we need to think about more as we're thinking about gaining Hebrew cultural literacy. Finally, Yahweh says, "For I, Yahweh, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed." Now, I've argued throughout my discussion of Malachi that Jacob is used very purposefully and very technically throughout Malachi to mean true Israel. So we have this prophecy of God coming and of Adonai coming and judging the whole world. And at that time, Yahweh will come and you will see that he is an expert witness against all of these people who are oppressive and think of God as this tool that they can manipulate, and adulterers and those who swear falsely. And then he says, "I do not change. Therefore you, O true Israel, are not consumed." That is, there are these people who are being oppressed, who are being hurt by the false Israel, by all Israel, right? There are consequences for true Israel as they live among the rest of Israel who are not faithful. The sorcerers, the priests who are offering these animals incorrectly, part of the consequences of that is the curse of God is coming upon them. And that curse is not just touching the priests, it's touching the whole community. And the true believers there are suffering because of that. The adulterers are hurting their wives, who it seems are attempting to be faithful to the covenant that they have with their husbands. Those who swear falsely, they are hurting people that they have made promises to. They are not interested in being truthful. And that certainly has consequences for everybody. And then the wage earner and the widow and the orphan and the alien are sort of by definition people who are most vulnerable to the kind of oppression that Yahweh is opposed to. And in this moment, Yahweh sort of turns reassuringly to this sort of small group in the back of this chorus that we've been looking at and says, "I don't change, so you will not be consumed. You will not be consumed because I don't change. I am going to preserve true Israel." All right. "From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them. Return to me and I will return to you, says Yahweh of hosts." So we're beginning the same formula we've seen time and time again. "But you say, how shall we return?" I think the idea is, what do we have to return from? And Yahweh responds, "Will a man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you?" Again, they're clueless. He says, "In tithes and offerings, you are cursed with a curse. For you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this, says Yahweh of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows. Then I will rebuke the devourer for you, so that it will not destroy the fruits of the ground, nor will your vine in the field cast its grapes, says Yahweh of hosts." So here we sort of have the final piece that paints the situation that we are in. He says, "You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me." So they are cursed with a curse. What does that curse entail? Well, he goes on and says, "I will open the windows of heaven." So there hasn't been rain. There's drought, which means that the crops are not as healthy as they could be. And he says, "I will rebuke the devourer for you." Now, the devourer is a word in Hebrew, and I would not be surprised in other Semitic languages. There are a lot of words for grasshopper. So the devourer is a term which refers to a specific kind of grasshopper. And apparently they have had drought and they have had the rest of their food eaten by these insects. And they are destroying the fruits of the ground. And he says, "Nor will your vine in the field cast its grapes." So they have been unsuccessful in harvesting food such that there is a famine because they are cursed because of all of the things they have been doing that Yahweh is angry at them for. They have not been keeping the commandment, and so God has cursed them like he said he would do in Deuteronomy. And when they wonder at that and try other things to get at things, Yahweh is saying, stop doing that. Stop not following the commandment. Do what I said to do in the commandment, and then I will bless you. Test me on this. Try it out. See if it will not be true that if you do what I have said in the commandment of offering tithes and offerings specifically, that I will not let the rain come and rebuke the devourer so that you can have food in abundance. Now again, as we have seen throughout all of Malachi, Malachi prophesies things that will be done in the end. This is, as usual, God is really off putting this on the table. But I do not think we will see this until the end when Yahweh finally makes Israel into the kingdom of priests. And he says as much, "All the nations will call you blessed, for you shall be a delightful land." So there is going to come a day when the children of Israel take God seriously, take on his covenant, and then God will open the windows of heaven and pour out his blessing until it overflows. Because God has made the children of Israel a signal. He has made them a sign to the people of the world. They are a sign because they embody explicitly, they show when they are following God, they are blessed. When they don't follow God, they are cursed. What Yahweh is saying is, if you follow me, then you will be blessed physically, right? The thing I talked about in Ezra and Nehemiah is that there's this separation between sort of the visible signs of wealth and the actual being favored by God. But in Israel, that picture is a lot less clear because they're so tied together. The visible signs are there to show what your ultimate destiny is going to be. And the curse is making it easier for you to realize that you have not correctly followed my instruction. So, people are neglecting the storehouse. Now remember, the storehouse was where Tobiah had an apartment when Nehemiah came back from his reform. So this is one of those things that people point to show that this is probably during that time when Nehemiah had gone back to Persia. And it could be that is, but it would not surprise me that there are other times where the storehouse is neglected, even not in the time of Nehemiah. Many of these problems seem to be problems that were probably true of Israel throughout their history and in this case happened to be after the Second Temple. In a lot of ways, Malachi is about the basic relationship between God and his people and how God is going to continue to be faithful to them even if they are unfaithful. And the way that he's going to be faithful is he is going to come and he is going to separate the wheat from the chaff, the wool from the grime. So if they will do what he has said in his commandments, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, he will again bless them. It is important to note, as far as I can tell, The storehouse is not only used for the priests and the Levites. Apparently, this is also where the food for the wage earner, the widow and the orphan, and the alien all is. That part of the reason for the storehouse was that is where they kept the food that they would give out to these people who are very vulnerable. Which means that by ignoring the storehouse, they have further injured those people. Okay, let's move on. Again, we have Yahweh or Malachi and the chorus. Your words have been arrogance against me, says Yahweh. Yet you say, how have we spoken against you? You have said, again, if you were soliloquizing, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we have kept his charge and that we have walked in mourning before Yahweh of hosts? So now we call the arrogant blessed. Not only are the doers of wickedness built up, but they also test God and escape. It's very interesting because there is not a response. God does not say in the end, this is what's going to happen. Well, I mean, he does it in a way, but it's very striking that these people have decided that it is of no use to serve God. As I was talking about earlier, cynicism is the death of good things. These people have said, it's no use to serve God. If you serve God, you just get taken advantage of. If you serve God, the wicked, they prosper, they get built up, and God doesn't punish them. So what is the value of serving God? God's response is not to tell them what will happen in the end. What we have instead is a part of the chorus turns away from the mass of the chorus. It's almost as if that back row, which we had talked about earlier, being the people who were faithful, it's almost as if they walk off of those, you know, the risers that you have the chorus standing on, and they gather in a little circle, sort of forward of the stage, and they say, and then this happens. Then those who feared Yahweh spoke to one another, and Yahweh gave attention and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear Yahweh and who esteem his name. So here's our stage play. We've had this chorus. We've had Yahweh speaking to different people in the chorus. And we've had a mention of sort of the people in the back row who aren't really getting a hearing, who aren't really participating, but who are part of all of Israel. And they finally come forward of the stage and they speak to each other. And then there is a second actor, right, who comes to the stage and has a book, and it looks at the people who are in this group who have separated themselves from the rest of the chorus, and they start writing down these people's names. They will be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, on the day that I prepare my own possession, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. So here is where we get, in the end, that group, this chorus of the people who fear Yahweh, who have removed themselves from this other chorus, they will be Yahweh's. And they will be preserved while all of the rest of the chorus is going to be done away with. Then he says, so you will again distinguish between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve him. So in that day, in the end, the people who fear Yahweh will be preserved and those who don't will not be. And that is when you will know that Yahweh loves the righteous and hates the wicked. 4:1. For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day that is coming will set them ablaze, says Yahweh of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. The evildoer, the arrogant, they're going to be totally done away with. The image of the fire, of the refiner's fire, here it's modified, so it's a furnace, right? We are throwing in chaff, right? Chaff is more of a grain sort of image. All of the things that need to be done away with will be done away with in the day that is coming. All right. But for you who fear my name, the Sun of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall. You will tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day which I am preparing. So we have this image of a burning fire, right? If you recall, it's interesting that God is often depicted as smoke and as a fire, right? He is the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. But when Abraham offers, he has this dream where he cuts up the different animals, and then you have a fire and a smoking pot sort of going through them. So I think here again, you have that same imagery, right? You have this burning furnace that is smoking because it is burning all of the things that need to be burned away. But the righteous, the same sort of chemical reaction, if you will, it doesn't touch them in the same way. It doesn't burn them away. It comes like the sun in the sunrise, and it comes with healing in its wings. You can just imagine a sunrise that comes and it gives warmth and it gives life and it starts growing things out of the ground. And so you have the same God who is the smoke and the fire, utterly destroying the wicked and then enlivening the righteous. He says, you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall. And you can just imagine, you know, animals, you know, calves just jumping around because they're just so gleeful and excited. And there's, you know, clover and whatnot to eat. And they're not sort of confined in the stall anymore, right? They're not sort of stuck where they can't move very much. They have free rein to joy in their existence. And that's going to be the lot of the righteous. And they will tread down the wicked, not because they are, you know, physically crushing the wicked. It's not necessary for them to do anything, but all that will be left of the wicked will be ash. They'll be totally gone. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all of Israel, which, as we have seen, has been the whole game, right? The priests are not passing on the commandments. People don't value the commandments. What we need is we need the messenger of the covenant in which you delight to come. And he needs the king of Israel, who is the expert on the law. We need him to come and we need him to restore the commandment. And so it is important in the meantime for the people to remember the law of Moses and for them to remember the statutes and ordinances which God commanded to Moses in Horeb. Don't take a part of the law. Take the whole law. I have said to a lot of people, so I don't think I've said it in this context, but I think it's very interesting. I don't think this is what Jesus was getting at exactly, but I feel free to riff on what Jesus was saying. I think it's very interesting that Jesus said, if you hear my words, you're building your house on a rock. And then he opposed that to building your house on the sand. And I think it's very interesting to think about how sand is made up of little rocks. That if you take a piece of sand, that piece of sand is as adamantine as that rock is. But the thing that is lacking in sand is that all of the adamantine pieces are not organized, are not connected, do not make up a whole that the rock makes up. The problem with the Pharisees was not that they didn't read the scripture, that they didn't follow commandments. It's that they only followed part of them. They could quote you chapter and verse, but they didn't have any idea how those chapters and verses went together until it formed a whole picture of what was going on. And that's Jesus's whole complaint is, you know, you don't love people. You have the whole Old Testament and you've focused on these little tidbits, but you don't have the whole picture. And in the case of Malachi, these people are offering offerings, to give an example. They're offering offerings, and the thing is not the conscience of the worshiper. The thing is not the contrition they have before God. It's, can we actually put a physical animal on the offering? That's good enough. It doesn't matter if they're blind. It doesn't matter if they're lame. It doesn't matter if we think anything in our thoughts or regard Yahweh in any way. As long as we're flipping the switch, everything's good. But to take God seriously, you have to take his commandments seriously. You have to take the whole law seriously. And the whole law involves loving your neighbor. It involves loving your enemy. It involves loving God with your whole heart and soul and mind and strength. And so if you are going to keep the law of Moses, you can't just base your worship on only offering animal bodies. You have to offer your whole self. Last section. Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of Yahweh. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. There's a lot of question about who Elijah is. What does it look like for Elijah to come before the great and terrible day of the Lord? Jesus equates John the Baptist to Elijah, but John says that he's not Elijah. So what are we to do with that? I think that Elijah is standing for a particular kind of prophet. I would not be surprised, because Elijah went up in the fiery chariot and did not die, if the role of Elijah was played by the man Elijah himself. But I think that there is something about the prophet Elijah that we can observe, which would indicate to us that we should expect of whoever plays the role of Elijah, even Elijah himself, before the coming of the great and terrible day of Yahweh. If we think about the history of Israel, there are only two periods of time before the time of Jesus where God acted overtly in history to make it clear that he was doing things. The first time was with Moses, with the plagues in Egypt, with the parting of the Red Sea, with the fire and smoke on the mountain, with the curses that he brought upon the people of Israel who were disobedient. Very clearly, God is working overtly in history. The other occasion on which God acts overtly in history is the time of Elijah and Elisha. Obviously, the most dramatic instance of this is when the prophets of Baal offer their ox. They're all running around and singing and cutting themselves, and Elijah is making fun of them. And then not only does Elijah ask for God to consume the ox, but he pours so much water on it that it would be inconceivable to even get a fire started if you were to do it manually. And then God sends down fire from heaven that consumes the ox and all of the water that Elijah has poured on it. The difference between Moses and Elijah is that Moses is there at the establishing of Israel. That in a way we're sort of ascending to this point where we are seeing the people of God, we are seeing the children of Israel sort of get to their highest point. They're getting to the place where they've been given the commandments and they're the children of priests. Now, they kind of plateau after that. We sort of have this wave of them being disobedient and then deciding that that's a bad idea, getting conquered by people, having judges come and save them. In Elijah, Israel is in a very wicked place. He is opposed to two of the most evil monarchs that Israel ever has. And so I think Moses brings a message of hope. There is this curse that has been on the human race since the garden. And in giving the commandments and giving the Torah, Moses is providing this way to escape. You want a solution to the problem of death? Take God seriously enough to follow his commandments. Elijah is bringing a different message. Elijah is bringing the message that you are all idolaters and God is going to utterly consume you because you are unworthy. So I think if we are looking for Elijah in history or the future, that what we are looking for is someone who is saying that everything is not okay. We are looking for somebody who is condemning what is happening in the world. I also would not be surprised if they were capable of doing something miraculous that backs up what they're saying. I suspect that as we get into the end, and I have not studied, you know, eschatology and Revelation as much as some of the other folks around here, there is some talk of the beast that comes out of the sea and of the Antichrist being able to perform miracles. But it's interesting that if you sort of think about sort of what's the message that they're giving, the message is everything's great, we're making progress, we're going forward, we're going to build Babel again. And Elijah's saying, no, everything's wrong. And so it will still take discernment to tease out who is telling the truth there. But for my money, if we're betting, which I don't have a lot at stake in betting this, when we find Elijah, he will be telling the world that they are due to be cursed by God. But that's not the only thing he's going to do. He's going to restore the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers. That's a complicated phrase. I don't know exactly what to do with all the parts of it, but there were fathers, right? There were the patriarchs who had hearts oriented towards God. And when Elijah comes, he will restore the children to their fathers. So the people of Israel will one day have the same faith that Abraham did, have the same faith that Isaac and Jacob had, have the same faith that David had. And that is part of what Elijah is doing besides pronouncing doom before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And he is going to do that so that Yahweh will not come and smite the land with a curse. God is a God of in the end. I think Malachi is the clearest example of this. I think this is true of all the prophetic literature, but I think Malachi puts it in sort of stark relief. I hear a lot of discussion these days about how this is, you know, the real world, and we need to sort of get over this idea that there is some kind of metaphysical reality beyond this one. And we need to realize that even in the Bible, what they were talking about is sort of inner states. I believe Ron has talked about Imagine by John Lennon before, right? That the fundamental view of that song is that we need to stop getting hung up on this idea of Judgment Day and start and realize that Judgment Day isn't really a real thing that's going to happen in the future. It's a sort of mental state or something that we sort of take on responsibility for our lives in the here and now. I think there's a lot of philosophizing that is in that vein that is possibly more subtle than that. But Malachi continues to tell us that God is a God of in the end. The reason why you will know God is a God of justice, why he is a great God, why he is a God to be worshipped, is because at the end of the story of history, it will be evident that God has been in the right all along, and that we should have worshipped him all along, because he was right, because he loves goodness, because he is interested in holding up the righteous and destroying the wicked. But if we don't trust God now, if we're cynical and we think that we've seen through all of that, that we've seen through this idea that someday God will come and fix things, we have already killed good things. Our hope is in the end, and we need to hold out right now, because in the end, God is going to, he's going to save us, and he's going to make everything right. Okay, that was Malachi. I hope that that was profitable for you. Thank you, everybody, who has been here for Ezra and Nehemiah and for the book of Malachi. Again, I hope they were both profitable. I hope they have helped you in your quest to be more culturally literate in the culture of the Hebrew Old Testament, Hebrew cultural literacy. I hope that that's helped you. I hope that they've helped you because they just have a lot of wisdom to share, and I hope I've highlighted some of that. All right. Thank you for your time and attention. All right.